Kia ora. This program is brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard.
Good morning to you. Welcome to Quilted Bananas. Here we are. This is sponsored by the generously sponsored by the Rural Foundation. We're here every Sunday between 10 and 11 a.m. on Access Radio 106.1 FM, Tafonga Nui Atara. And we are a radio show for queer, intersex, lesbian, trans, takatapui, MB, diverse, bisexual, asexual, and actual nanas, literal or metaphorical, depending on how you feel about it. And today we are on another episode of Stuff and Nonsense. I've got Fiona with me in the studio as my technical assistant.
Good morning.
I've decided finally to give up on my own attempts to have any kind of technical input. I think it's safe for all of us if I just leave it to the professionals. And today is an interesting day. So you've noticed in the past I've had a habit of going through things such as, you know, what has happened on this day in the past. And I was planning on doing something a little bit different today, but as usual, you know, best laid plans, all of that jazz. Because starting tomorrow is Youth Week. So between the 18th and 24th of May, we have Youth Week. And I was hoping to convince some youth, from basically one of my kids, to come in and with some of their friends and discuss something to do with youthfulness. But because they're teenagers, they said, absolutely not. I would not be seen dead doing stuff with my mum, especially in public. So that went out the window. And I thought, well, technically, it's not actually Youth Week yet, so I can sort of pass the buck. So what I went with is I've kind of gone back to what first involved me with Quilted Bananas, and that is talking about the past. I mean, I always talk about the past, but this is the ancient past. And I thought what I would have a go at would be doing actually teenage queens. So I thought, well, that's youthful. That does definitely very much involve youth. So what I'm going to do a quick, it's kind of brief history with some probably random tangents, as I always do, is a look at a couple of teenage queens from ancient Egypt. And there's going to be, excuse me, so Fiona, if I say ancient Egyptian queens, it's the very first thing that comes to your mind.
Cleopatra.
Cleopatra. Cleopatra. And Cleopatra was indeed a teenage queen. So normally I'm famous amongst my friends for wanting to do everything in chronological order. So normally I start at the beginning and work my way forwards. What I'm going to do today is I'm going to be a slightly rebellious for me, and I'm going to start with Cleopatra because, ironically, perhaps I'm going to give her a little bit less time in this than my main starring character of today. Cleopatra was indeed a teenage queen. So Cleopatra, who is Cleopatra the Seventh, was born in 69 BC, and she became the monarch of, or one of the monarchs of Egypt, in 51 BC. So when she was 18 years old. And actually, Fiona, if you could start lining up the first song, because I'm going to do some music to begin with, and then we will go into a very brief history of Cleopatra. The music I've chosen today is actually all by Egyptian female artists. The first song is a woman by a singer called Amal Maher, who is quite interesting because she disappeared for a while and has kind of sort of come back. And this is a song called Sekhet El Salama. And Sekhet El Salama means basically, get out of my face. Take the safe road. You don't want to go there. So this is a very pretty way of going, shove off.
I'm
So that was Amel Ma with Seket El Salama, Take the Safe Road. Get out of my face, from 2015. And she's a very interesting woman. If you want to find out stuff about her, feel free to Google her. She's an interesting person to find out about. So Cleopatra the VII, born 69 BC, came to the throne in 51 BC, so when she was 18 years old. But she didn't come to the throne just in her own right. She came to the throne as a partnership with her brother, Ptolemy the 13th, who we believe was a younger brother. The interesting thing about the Ptolemies, we could go into the Ptolemies in great detail. They were slightly different to the traditional Egyptian pharaohs in that they were a Greek dynasty. They had been put in position by Alexander the Great when he came into Egypt in 332 BC. So they ruled Egypt for just over 300 years. And so they didn't tend to consider themselves to be Egyptians. They were kind of these Greek Egyptians, and they didn't really they didn't speak the Egyptian language. Cleopatra famously did, but she was the only one. And they did certainly work in a slightly different way to the traditional Egyptian pharaohs that we think of. So when Cleopatra came to the throne at the age of 18, alongside her brother Ptolemy the 13th, at this point, Egypt was not what it used to be, to say the least. Egypt was in, had gone through quite a lot of upheaval and was in huge amounts of debt to a Roman banker, I believe. And so basically, Egypt was paying off debt. So it wasn't a kind of financially independent country. And the other big thing was at this time, obviously, Rome was really, really coming into its own. This was the period of Julius Caesar. So Rome's famous empire was really starting to kind of come into its own. And Caesar was very interested in Egypt because Egypt was not only nearby, but Egypt was famous for the fact that it had incredibly good farming and it was had a lot of gold. It looked really flashy, it looked really fancy. The Romans weren't so keen on Egypt because they thought it was a bit, seemed a bit decadent, a bit iffy, a bit, you know, they were a bit dodgy, those Egyptian types. So the Romans thought they were a bit too loose with their morals. But obviously Egypt and Rome had to have some kind of relationship because Egypt was beholden to this Roman banker. And so they needed to kind of figure out a way to work together. Julius Caesar comes to Egypt in 48 BC. And this is a big deal because he's a foreign dignitary, but he's a much more powerful foreign dignitary than they are. So it's this really interesting power balance. Famously, Cleopatra gets to meet Julius Caesar with this legendary story about her being carried in a carpet, which does seem to be perhaps true. The interesting thing about Cleopatra is most of what we know about her, we know from later Roman historians. So we don't have any really much contemporary information about her, which is why you have this idea that is mostly put in our heads from Shakespeare and movies, which was put into Shakespeare's head from these Roman historians. But we don't have any contemporary reports of who she was or what she was like. So when her brother was 3 years younger than her, Ptolemy the 13th, he was 15 years old. So she was obviously kind of, although he was technically the more powerful party, she was probably the slightly more wily party. And Cleopatra and Julius Caesar got together in 48 BC. She got smuggled into his palace. And not long after that, 47 BC, they had a child together, Ptolemy Caesar, known as Caesarion. And there's always this big thing about, you know, was Cleopatra this big, you know, vampy beauty? What was going on here? It's really hard to tell, and it's a massive debate because Julius Caesar would have been a much older man, you know, easily nearly, I think, nearly 30 years older than her. But he was also famous for seducing local leaders of both genders, apparently, or any gender, sorry, both genders, both sexes. He would basically, he could seduce anyone. And it's so, it's almost like kind of like met like. These two people that were able to, had the most charisma, met each other. And it does seem to be that this would have been not only a political relationship, but it would have also, there does seem to have been a kind of a meeting of minds because Caesar was really quite taken with Cleopatra. Ptolemy the 13th, this wasn't a good thing for him at all. not even slightly. And so in, bear in mind, so Julius Caesar arrives in Egypt in 48 BC. Their son is born in 47 BC. Ptolemy the 13th dies in 47 BC. He drowns trying to escape. He makes a couple of really, really bad choices politically, tries to get out of it, is trying to get across the river and actually drowns. So at this point, the next king is put in place, who is Ptolemy the 14th. So at this point, Ptolemy the 14th, who is another younger sibling, who is 11 years old at this point, and Cleopatra's 22, comes on to the throne at 47 BC. So Cleopatra's still ruling, technically, alongside another, a man. This is where it gets really complicated, because Cleopatra and Caesar go to Rome. And this is where things get really messy, because the Romans don't particularly like the Egyptians. They think they're a bit, I say, decadent and dodgy. And Caesar basically proceeds to present Cleopatra as being this absolutely amazing, fantastic, you know, she's the business. He puts up a gold statue to her, which goes down really badly with the Romans. What the hell? You know, at this point, she's 25 years old. They're probably like going, oh my God, he's having a massive midlife crisis. What the hell? And this, obviously, so 44 BC, they're in Egypt and Caesar's assassinated. At this point, what happens is Ptolemy the... When he's assassinated, at this point, Cleopatra has to get out of Egypt. Sorry, get out of Rome and get back to Egypt, because it's not really safe for her to be in Rome. By pure coincidence, I'm absolutely sure, when she's on her way back to Egypt or in the same year, Ptolemy the 14th is murdered. So Cleopatra basically comes back to Egypt, and not long, the same year, she becomes the queen regent to her son, Caesarion, Ptolemy Caesar, as he's the surviving male connection to the throne. And Ptolemy Caesar becomes Ptolemy the 15th, with Cleopatra as his queen regent. So the regent, which we will get to, at this point, Cleopatra is still only 25 years old. Completely bonkers. So now she's in a situation where Caesar's dead. So this is her big power move. He's gone. And you have these two, basically, factions. You have Caesar's assassins, and you have Mark Antony, Octavian, and Marcus Lepidus, who are basically the people who were on Caesar's team. And Cleopatra's got to try and decide which side she's going to go for. Her sister, Arsinoe, goes to Cyprus and tries to side with the assassin team. This, again, goes really badly. While she's trying to figure out which way to go, the assassins are captured and executed. So the only option then becomes between Octavian or Mark Antony, who have divided the former territory belonging to Caesar into east and west. And Mark Antony's in charge of half of that. And she chooses Mark Antony. And this is thought to be the only time that she actually makes the wrong choice. This was in, so 40 BC, she's taken up with Mark Antony. By this point, she's 29 years old. She's got, her son is on, technically on the throne of Egypt, which is becoming more or less a vassal state to Rome, but not quite. She is acting politically the leader of Egypt. And she gets involved with Mark Antony, and she actually, again, has children with him. She has twin children by him in 40 BC when she's 29, Cleopatra Selene and Alexander Helios. And in 36 BC, they have another child, Ptolemy Philadelphus. So this is the situation with Cleopatra. So you've got this woman who, from the age of 18 to 29, in over these 11 years, has gone through this complete bonkersness of, you know, becoming the monarch alongside her brother making all these terrible mistakes, her taking up with Julius Caesar, forming a political relationship and personal relationship with him, her brother dying, her younger brother coming in, being taken to Rome and treated as if she's, you know, the best thing since sliced bread, but then become, you know, kind of this absolute kind of kind of pariah to the Romans, to then coming back and then having to kind of recreate this relationship with Rome through Mark Antony. Creating this relationship with Mark Antony wasn't a bad idea. The only problem with it, and this is me making something incredibly complicated, incredibly simple, and people that know about Roman history will be sitting there going, oh, it's a lot more to it than that. But to cut a really long story really short, or a short story even shorter, Mark Antony was married to Octavian's sister, Octavia. So when he took up with Cleopatra, I don't think this was necessarily a big problem, but he basically put Cleopatra above Octavia, which went down really, really badly. And then Mark Antony and Cleopatra started to try and establish their own territory and their own lands and their own empire. One of the instances that I really love is when they ended up actually kicking Herod out of his own palace and then saying, oh, but if you want, you can rent it back from us. Apparently Herod hated Cleopatra. There are worse people to be hated by than King Herod, that's for sure. So this all obviously comes to a massive head with this battle between Mark Antony and Octavian, which Octavian wins. Mark Antony comes back to Egypt. They kind of trying to act like, oh, it's not a big deal. It's all fine. We can just carry on ruling in Egypt, but it's not going to work. Mark Antony in 30 BC goes out to fight what he knows will be basically his final battle against Octavian. And whilst during the course of this campaign, he gets word, so this is 30 BC, that Cleopatra has died. So he comes back, he has to be brought back to her, and she's actually trying to avoid being imprisoned by by Octavian. And how she's trying to avoid this is that she has been basically locked herself up in her treasury, which is also happens to be the mausoleum. And that sounds really awful, but a mausoleum and a treasury for the ancient Egyptians would be the kind of two most secure places you want to be. So she's holed up in there, effectively, kind of, you know, under siege. And Mark Antony comes back and he's been injured. He falls upon his sword when he thinks that she's dead. And he gets taken back to the mausoleum to be put with her in death. And he has to be winched up the outside of the building because they can't get into the building. They have to basically winch him up to one of the higher windows and put him through the window. They do this, and obviously what happens is that once they're inside there, they realise that Cleopatra isn't dead. This was just all a vicious rumour. So this is all very Romeo and Juliet, this stuff. Yeah. Wonder where Shakespeare got the idea from that story. No idea. But Mark Antony is dying. So Mark Antony dies in Cleopatra's arms, and after this, Cleopatra commits suicide, but we don't know how. We just know that she dies. And the reason she commits suicide is because the alternative would effectively be to be taken to Rome and be paraded through the streets, you know, as a prisoner of Octavian. So 30 BC, Cleopatra at this point, not even 40, 39 years old, is dead. Her three children, so she has Caesarion, who is by Julius Caesar, and then the twins and the younger son by Mark Antony. Caesarion is executed by Octavian, attempting to escape in 30 BC, so he makes it to 17 years old. Cleopatra, Selene, Alexander, Helios, and Ptolemy Philadelphus are actually put into the care of Octavia, Mark Antony's wife, to raise... could be worse, I suppose. We don't know a huge amount what happened to them. Cleopatra Selene was married off to a man called Juba II, a prince of Numidia, and had a child, which she very originally called Ptolemy. Alexander and Ptolemy Philadelphus apparently were sent off to live somewhere near their sister and just died in obscurity. They actually got to kind of outlive all these things. The drama doesn't end there. Ptolemy, the son of Cleopatra Selene, so the grandchild of Cleopatra and Mark Antony, ended up being murdered by Caligula in AD 40. So not a fun family to be in. So that's the kind of obvious teenage queen of ancient Egypt. What are going to get Fiona to play our next song, which is a really interesting one. Again, this is by an artist called Lella Fada, and it's called Fokak Meni. And Fokak Meni is modern Egyptian slang for piss off. So this is an Egyptian woman basically saying, you know, if you think I'm going to do what you want me to do, just piss off. Have fun with this one. It's great.
أولى تجاربها التمثيلية بمسلسل برنس للا فضة زيك للا فضة للا فضة للا 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 فضة للا فضة للا 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 يا قصة شعري بس الأطول أحلى كتير عايزة أصحى الصبح ما روحش الشغلي أروح باريس طويلة وبلبس كعب مع إنه مش مريح كل دي حاجة تشغليني أكتر منه بكتير أكتر منه بكتير أكتر منه بكتير لما أكسب هكسب هكسب أكتر منه بكتير أكتر منه بكتير أكتر منه بكتير في ميت واحد أحبهم أكتر منه مش بحب الصيف عشان بيخلي شعري هيش مقفل الشباك بكره صوت العصافير الصبح لما صحيت نزلت الأوبر كان غريب كل دي حاجة تشغليني أكتر منه بكتير أكتر منه بكتير أكتر منه بكتير لو نزلت الجمعة شيل أكتر منه بكتير أكتر منه بكتير أكتر منه بكتير لا 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 أنت بجرامي أشتا أنا بجسمي فكك مني فكك فكك مني مني فكك مني فكك فكك مني مني فكك مني فكك فكك مني مني فكك مني فكك للا فكك مني فكك فكك There you go. Lella Fada. It's quite good. It's not really what you expect of Egyptian music, is it? Especially not Egyptian women's music. But there's some quite good, like, underground stuff that you can track down if you really set your mind to it. So that was Cleopatra, the most famous ancient Egyptian queen and one of the most famous teenagers in the world. People do associate ancient Egyptian monarchy with teenagers and young people for the obvious reason of Tutankhamun, who was on the throne roughly between the ages of 9 and 18. And because in the olden days, people tended to die relatively young, and so they would come into maturity relatively young. But if you were rich, then you could live a quite grand old age. But Cleopatra, see, the interesting thing with Cleopatra was she was always a queen regent. She never declared herself actual full monarch of Egypt. And the most famous person that most people haven't heard of, if you study ancient Egypt, you will know this name. If you don't, you probably will go, hang on, I've not heard of this person. You maybe have, maybe not, is a monarch called Hatshepsut. And Hatshepsut means foremost amongst the women. And Hatshepsut was around at the beginning of the 18th dynasty. The 18th dynasty is the period of Egypt that everyone knows about without knowing that they know about it. All of the things in movies except for pyramids and Moses is all 18th dynasty. Tutankhamun's 18th dynasty, Nefertiti's 18th dynasty, the massive temples 18th dynasty, Valley of the Kings began the 18th dynasty. All of the stuff that you kind of see as cliche stuff is all 18th dynasty. So Hatshepsut is around at the early part of this. And the background of her reign is really important because what happens is in 1539 BC, so we're going back a full 1500 years, roughly, before Cleopatra, Egypt had spent about just under a century being divided into two different regions ruled by two different sets of people. In the north, we had a group that are known as the Hyksos, or rulers of foreign lands. And in the south, we had the Egyptians themselves ruling the southern part of Egypt. Egypt was always considered to be two kingdoms that were united under one king, the north and the south. And so at the end of the 17th dynasty, the
two lands were united, and when it became united, this is when we get the start of the 18th dynasty. That's why this dynasty begins. And what had happened during this period, the southern kings from the area that's now modern Luxor had been fighting against the northern kings, trying to kind of force them back out of the country. And the first king of the 18th dynasty is a man called Akhmose. This gets really confusing because Egyptian names aren't necessarily gender specific. So you can have Akhmoses who are male and Akhmoses who are female, because ancient Egyptian names are about just their relationships with gods a lot of the time. Akhmose came to the throne after the death of his father in battle. And there was another king in between of this called Karmose. He was only king for a very brief amount of time. And we think that he might have just been a general of the army. So he was effectively fighting. We know that the way the ancient Egyptians worked was that if a king was away fighting or doing anything like that, then the queen consort effectively ran the country on their behalf. So whilst Sekenre Tar was in battle, his wife would have been running the politics side of the country. And she was a woman called Akhotep. Sekenre Tar, we know what happened to him because we have his body. And his body is quite obvious because he's got a couple of really massive holes in his head that were made by axes. He's like, across his throat, he's got this massive hole that you can kind of just really clearly, like, the guy, and we even pretty much know what order it went in. They basically injured him enough to get him down on the ground, and then they stoved his head in. So we know what happened to him. And so Akhotep, his wife, the queen, took over effectively the rule of Egypt when Akhmose was still a small child. And it's estimated that for at least a decade, she would have been the person running Egypt on behalf of her son. And he actually acknowledges this, which is quite unusual. So he actually has this monument made to her, which he says, you know, basically she, not only did she run Egypt, but she defended Egypt and fought for Egypt. So there's this implication, and the burial includes these kind of slightly militaristic bits of funerary equipment. So there's a suggestion that she was effectively the military ruler as well at the time, which is quite a statement in those days. The way that we identify who is who in terms of their relationships with other people is through the titles that they have in ancient Egypt. So Akhotep held the title of king's daughter, so that means her father was the monarch. King's sister, so her brother was the monarch. King's great wife, so that means that she was the queen consort, because there were multiple queens, but the only one held the title of great wife, which meant that you were the one that acted as the kind of powerful queen. King's mother, so her child became a king, and God's wife. The God's wife one is really interesting, because what happened was that they developed this system wherein these queens had some degree of independent power. So we know she was royal. Her father was a king, her brother was a king, she was married to a king, and her son became a king. This is, you can't get much more really royal than that. And during this period, there was this sibling marriage system going on, because it was thought to preserve the purity of the royal line. It wasn't necessarily, you wouldn't necessarily be kind of, you know, 100% siblings. You might be half siblings. I know it doesn't make it any better, but it makes it a little bit worse. No, less worse, I should say. So when Akhmose became old enough to rule in his own right, his mother was still around, and he married a woman called Akhmose Nefertari, who, again, was actually one of his sisters. And she was, so Akhmose Nefertari was also the daughter of Akhotep and Sekenre Tar II. She also holds the titles king's daughter, king's sister, king's great wife, king's mother, God's wife. And now she gets a new title, second prophet of Amun. Yes, exactly. A second prophet of Amun was a title that was created. Effectively, what happened was Akhmose, this first king of the 18th dynasty, bought a chunk of land which was associated with the cult of Amun. Amun was the principal god of Egypt from that point onwards, and he was the principal god in what was ancient Wazet, modern Luxor. his temple, Amun's temple, is the Temple of Karnak, which is the still to this date, I believe, the largest religious complex in existence. It's absolutely massive. And from this point onwards, it had existed beforehand, but this point onwards, it became the center of the religious practice. And it was effectively every person that came to the throne added to this temple. They added their own part to it. And they were hugely powerful. And because temples owned land, they were hugely wealthy. And Akhmose effectively kind of bought into this. And he bought a title which became the second priesthood of Amun, or the second prophet of Amun, or God's wife of Amun, which he gave to Akhmose Nefertari, his wife, for her to belong to her completely. And this included land, everything the land produced, and the bureaucracy that ran the land. So you basically got given this huge swathe of estates, and they were for to hers completely. So they were hers, and they could be handed down to her descendants. So suddenly you have a queen who's independently wealthy. This means that what she also gets a title of called divine adoratrice, which means that she's allowed to make offerings to the gods in her own right. Thinking, yeah, big deal. In ancient Egypt, technically, the only person who can make an offering to the gods is the king, technically, because the only person the gods will communicate with is the king. They won't communicate with anyone else. So if anyone else is making an offering, they're making an offering on behalf of the king to the gods. You can't go, I'm giving you this. You could say, I'm giving this because the king said I'm allowed to. It's like, okay. But this means that she's allowed to make offerings in her own name, and that's massive. So this is huge amounts of money, and this kind of overt political power has been gifted to her. Right. So on we go. So this is the first. So you've had Akhotep, who's basically ruled Egypt for 10 years whilst her son was a child, followed by Akhmose marrying Akhmose Nefertari, who establish what becomes the most successful and wealthiest dynasty that Egypt has ever. And Akhmose Nefertari and Akhmose's son becomes the second king of the 18th dynasty, Amenhotep I. And again, he's a child. Akhmose, the king, dies fairly, well, his son's still quite young. So Akhmose Nefertari, much like her mother, becomes the queen regent on behalf of her son. So we've got two queens in a row who have ruled Egypt on behalf of their children until the child's old enough to become a ruler in their own right. Amenhotep marries a woman called Merit Amun, who again is another royal woman, but she dies relatively young and without having had any children. So what happens then is Akhmose Nefertari, his mother, comes back in, and she, rather than just being queen regent, she takes over the role of queen consort. And that sounds really dodgy, but it's not as dodgy as it sounds. It basically means she takes over all of the roles that the queen, the chief queen, would do. So she's basically being his political advisor, she's the one who's in charge if he's not there, all of these things. And this makes her quite a massive figure in Egyptian history and to the Egyptians themselves at the time. Because Amenhotep I doesn't have any children, he definitely doesn't have a son, they have to try and figure out who's going to take over. So they have to select who the next king is going to be. And Akhmose Nefertari would have definitely had a role in selecting this next monarch who was going to take over the throne of Egypt once her son died. And the man they selected was a man called Thutmose. And he becomes Thutmose I. These first, seconds, and thirds are all things that we put onto it. The ancient Egyptians didn't use these terms, but we use it because it's easier for us because we were Victorian British people at the time and it was nice and simple. So they select this guy who becomes Thutmose I. Amenhotep I dies. His mother's still around. So she lives into the reign of Thutmose I. So she lived through Akhmose's reign, her father's reign, her mother's regency, Akhmose's reign, Amenhotep I's reign, now into Thutmose I's reign. So she would have still had quite a chunk of political power. And we think that one of the ways that this marriage was, or this succession was arranged, was that Thutmose married one of Akhmose's daughters, a woman called Mutnofret. who may have been a daughter of Akhmose Nefertari, we're not sure. She died before he actually got to the throne. So he might have been basically a royal son-in-law. So when Thutmose I gets to the throne, I'm getting to the point, I promise you, there's going to be a teenage queen in here somewhere. You still got these women who are kind of used to having a really heavy influence. Thutmose I comes to the throne. This is only 33 years after the establishment of the 18th dynasty. So this is all happening in like boom, 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 boom. And he marries another Akhmose. And they have two daughters. The daughters are Nefru Biti and Hatshepsut. Thutmose is on the throne for roughly 12, 13 years. Not a bad amount of time. And then he dies as well. And he's got these two daughters by the principal queen. They can't become pharaoh because that's not how it works in ancient Egypt. It has to be a son if you've got one. So he has a son, which is by another one of the non-principal queens. And this son becomes Thutmose II. And Thutmose II, it gets complicated. Dates in ancient Egypt are a pain because the ancient Egyptians didn't record year dates the way that we do. There's some debate about whether Thutmose II was king for 12 years or for 3 years. This can muddy the water a little bit when we're trying to discuss this, but it's not too difficult. Either way, if Hatshepsut was born the year that her father became, Thutmose I became pharaoh, the year that Thutmose II becomes pharaoh, she would have been, she would have been maybe 12, 13 years old. Some people say she might have been born later. She may have been younger than that. We don't know because it all depends on these various dates. But at most, she was 12 or 13 years old when she became the queen consort of Egypt to what we presume was a younger brother. And also bear in mind that when Hatshepsut was a little kid, Akhmose Nefertari was still alive. So there is potential, we don't know, there's potential for overlap of her actually having known her, well, it would have been step-grandmother, who was this kind of super powerful queen and the daughter of the queen who helped you reunify Egypt. So you can see you've got this line of women who know what they're doing, have their own money, and know how to rule. So Hatshepsut becomes queen consort at the age, like say 12 or 13, maybe a bit younger. She holds the title of king's daughter because obviously she is Thutmose I's daughter, king's sister because she's Thutmose II's half-sister, king's great wife because she's the principal wife, and god's wife of Amun. So she's inherited this massive estate that was first granted to Akhmose Nefertari. Thutmose II and Hatshepsut have a child, one daughter called Neferure. Obviously, again, daughters aren't able to inherit the throne of Egypt. So although, say, Hatshepsut still has this position of fairly impressive levels of power, Thutmose II dies fairly young. Again, we don't know if it's after 12 years or after 3 years. Either way, he would have died fairly young. At most, if he was 12 years, maybe in his early 20s. Who knows?
Just a quick question. Mm-hmm. When people are dying, are they generally dying of natural causes as far as you know, or that there's...
Yeah, generally. Right. But we wouldn't know because the ancient Egyptians they never told you about a king dying. A king didn't die, you just got a new king. So it was never the king is dead, long live the king. It's just like, here's the new king. So you just get... And again, this is why the reign dates are just in the number of what we call reignal years or regnal years of the king. So you'll have Thutmose the first years, one, year two, year whatever, and then Thutmose the second year, one, year two, whatever. And the reign dates we have to go on is the only way we can frame the dates is by the latest date we find. Luckily, they like to stamp everything with dates. So that's why there's always this big argument about, well, have we found anything past this date? Does this fit with this date? Does this fit? But they would tell you the year things happened. So what we've got now is a situation where Thutmose, but also you've got to bear in mind that if, because we're having these sibling marriages, there's going to be a lot of probably genetic iffiness as well going on sometimes, or potential genetic iffiness. So now we have the situation, we have the fifth king of the 18th dynasty, and this is all, like I say, happened within a period of, 1539 roughly, we're now up to 1479. So this is a period of 50 years. We've had five kings in 50 years, most of them with these very powerful women around them. And so the son that is selected as being the king is the next Thutmose, Thutmose III. He's actually the most famous Thutmose. He was quite a bloke. And he's the son of Thutmose II and one of the minor queens. But again, he would have been a really small child when this happened. If Hatshepsut became queen consort at the age of 12 or 13, then she would have become the regent to Thutmose III as not, she's not his mother, but she's the most senior royal woman. So politically, she's the most powerful. At the age of roughly, would have been 24, 25. So at this point, if, in her mid-20s is the safest bet, because you can go around the whole thing about how old she was when her husband died and all this, when she became queen consort. But she would have been in her mid-20s. But by this point, she had been queen consort of Egypt for a decade. This is bonkers. I mean, like, imagine. So we go back to Tutankhamun being a child king. We've got this woman, this girl, who had effectively been the queen consort of Egypt since she was 12 years old. Wow. Now she's 24, say, 25, and she's the queen regent of Egypt. And this is not, this is kind of, when I say it's not unusual, but it's quite a thing. This is where the big change comes in. So Hatshepsut, what Hatshepsut does that no one else has ever done. Some suggest that she might have been as young as 16 years old when she became queen regent. We're not sure the same. She was the only person to really take on this title and hold the title of the monarch of Egypt in her own right during a period of peace and prosperity. We have a couple of other examples of women who took on the full royal titulary of a king, but none of, only in times when there were those like real desperate measures. The default monarch of Egypt was a man, and it passed from father to child. But you say, if their child was too young to be politically savvy, then the mother or the senior queen would basically act as their political guide, as regent. At this point, this person, the regent, would be either the previous king's wife or the king's mother, and the god's wife of Amun, because they had the wealth and the power. They had enough oomph to be able to get people to do what they needed to do. And what happened, so Hatshepsut takes on this role in our date frame, we put it around 1749 BC. Nothing exciting there. This has happened before. Like I say, her great-grandmother did it for 10 years, no big deal. The shift is in 1472 BC. So this is after 7 years of this regency. She shifts things and she takes on the titles of a king. This is, what? So she basically declares herself, not just Queen Rich, she declares herself as a co-king alongside Thutmose. So there are two kings. This is really interesting, because one of the reasons that we know about Hatshepsut, because a lot of her, the information about her was destroyed. One of the reasons we know about it was because when they were back in the 1800s trying to translate or decipher hieroglyphs, they couldn't figure out why they had a set of hieroglyphs that were gave the titles of a king but had basically effectively feminine pronouns. So like, what the hell is going on? This says this person's a king and the statues are of a king, but it also says this is a woman. What's going on? And this is where it gets into this kind of really complicated thing. And this came up relatively recently because someone was talking about the fact that there was a very, very brief kind of very surface cartoon illustrated graphic article about whether Hatshepsut was transgender, and that's a whole minefield to get into. Because when you're doing things like that, what you're doing is you're trying to transpose modern concepts of gender onto ancient peoples that we have. We cannot know what they were thinking. We can recognise what they did, but we cannot understand why they did it or how, what the impact of it had. But we know that Hatshepsut, at this point, basically declared herself as not just Queen Regent, but as the co-monarch alongside Thutmose III. And there's always been a lot of debate about this, because there's always been that, you know, the archetypes is that we project back onto this was that, you know, she was the wicked stepmother. She wasn't his mother, but she was married to his father and she stopped him from becoming king, all of this stuff. That doesn't seem to be the case, because A, he was still king, and B, he was, as he got older and got into his teens, he was actually put in charge of the military, which would be a really stupid thing to do if you were trying to repress someone. And he is known subsequently as being the greatest military leader that ancient Egypt ever had. That's what he was famous for, his conquest and expansion of empire. So what we first have is that we first have Hatshepsut presenting herself as a female king. So you get the words for king, but they've been given a feminine, grammatically they're feminized. We have statues where Hatshepsut is wearing the crowns, the headdresses associated with kingship, but you can still see it's clearly a woman wearing these in statuary. So it's basically, I always describe it the same way as if you get Queen Elizabeth II, she wears the same crown that King Charles III wears. But until this point, a woman had never worn those crowns. So she's wearing all of these things. She's wearing the monarch's full monarch's uniform. The difference is that in ancient Egypt, the monarch's uniform is for a man, and it's all to do with masculinity. So it's things like bull's tails and these kind of short kilts and being really buff and all of this stuff, and a false beard and all of these things. So when you put them on a woman, you're going to be like, well, that's a bit peculiar, but if she's wearing them, then must be, yeah, okay, fine. And the first representations are of her as this female king are at Karnak, this major temple associated with Amun, the Theban capital, kind of, you know, where all the power is. What happens is in year 7, perhaps a bit earlier, but it's definitely recorded from year 7 onwards, is that basically it's stated that she was chosen by Amun to be king, and that her father, Thutmose I, wanted her to rule Egypt. In order for this to happen, this has to be fully backed by the priesthood as well. So she's got all of this political power working in her favour to say that basically the gods wanted her to be ruling. And she could only hold this position, we think, because the person that they would have assumed to be King Thutmose III, she never tried to get rid of him. She never said, he's not king, I am. She just said, we're ruling together. We're equal parties in this. Although she would have had the actual, obviously the more power, because she was basically senior and smarter and more politically savvy. So you've got this woman who at this point would have been on the throne of Egypt, either as queen consort, queen regent, or as king, as we say the word king. We don't know what the ancient Egyptian word for king was. We just call them a king. And by this point, it would have been for how many years? Nearly 20 years. And she's still only going to be in her 20s, early 30s maybe. What happened to Hatshepsut is kind of part of an interesting story. So she remained as co-monarch, co-ruler, king, effectively, of Egypt until her death in 1458, at which point we estimate she would have been around maybe 47, 48 years old. So she got 10 years on Cleopatra. No, hang on. Cleopatra wasn't quite 40. And she would have been, let's say, for two-thirds, three-quarters of her life, she would have been ruling Egypt. As far as we know, she was granted a full royal burial as a monarch,
There is some debate about what happened to her body. This would have been in the very early stages of Valley of the Kings. Her mortuary temple still exists. Bits of it were destroyed. And there was always this thing, idea about the reason that parts of it were destroyed was because they wanted to get rid of her name. And we think this did happen because the Egyptians believed that if you got rid of someone's name, you destroyed them. But this only happened in places where her name was very public, and it happened quite late in Thutmose III's reign. And what you have to understand about Thutmose III is that these other kings have been around maybe doing 10 years, 13 years each. Thutmose III was on the throne for over 40 years. So he had plenty of time to do this. And it happened towards the end of his reign. And this, some suggestion is that it happened because he wanted to make sure that his son, who was coming to the throne, would be seen as the direct descendant of the one king. So we don't know exactly why. And it wasn't that everything was destroyed. I mean, there's still plenty of monuments to Hatshepsut that exist. They didn't wipe her name out completely. They just, in certain places, removed her name. So the suggestion is that she was a woman who was fulfilling the role that she had understood from her great-grandmother, grandmother, and mother, who then took it to the next stage of going, actually, I could just do this. And the priesthood were like going, well, actually, you've got all the money and the oomph, why not? The debate around what she was trying to present herself as physically or in terms of gender is extraordinarily complicated. I would really not want to get into that in terms of trying to compare it to modern gender concepts, because I think we're just getting into some very big trouble. But when it comes to teenage queens, you don't really get much bigger than the teenage girl and 20-something girl woman who ruled Egypt at its most wealthy and most powerful and died of natural causes. So absolutely outrageous. So that's a brief, very brief history of Hatshepsut. I can get into the other stuff later.
Incredible stories.
Yes. We're going to finish off with a song by another Egyptian musician, a woman called Juno. And this is The Power of She. So enjoy this, and thank you very much for listening. It's been fun.
The program was brought to you by Wellington Access Radio. Get your voice heard. Thanks New Zealand On Air for funding accessmedia.nz.